Hello, everyone, and welcome to Local Matters. This is Ben Rogers. Excited to have Congressman John Rose with us today. And Congressman, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me on 94.1.
Yeah, I know your time is valuable and you are busy. You're in the middle of passing a big, beautiful bill, which we will get into. But I do want to say, this is, I think, at least the second time, maybe the third time you've been on, and I do appreciate you taking the time to be on Local Matters and my show. Because the people love to hear from you, and they love to have see the interaction we have and talk about government and talk about our area and the district you serve, which is the 6th Congressional District. But I appreciate you being here, and I want to brag on you because my career changed this past year, and I was down at the General Assembly for the first time, full time. And I saw you several times in the halls at the Cordell Hull building. And you spoke to me and was very kind, and I appreciate that. But more importantly, you were there with our legislators. And I don't know if that's common for congressmen to come to their local state legislature and visit and talk, but I appreciate you doing that. So,
well, thank you. Yes. So we've tried to do that each year since I've been in Congress and just stay in touch with legislators, particularly those in the 6th district area that I represent, but also beyond the 6th district. And so, it's just interesting to hear the issues that they have and how those interface with federal policy and what I'm doing in Washington. And so it puts us in a better position to be able to address concerns that they have and issues where, what we're doing in Washington might impact what they're doing in the state legislature.
Yeah, I mean, federal government, state government are not always doing the same thing, but they're often working together on providing the same quality of life for their residents, right?
Absolutely. And I try to stay in my lane. Sometimes that gets hard because people sometimes the electorate doesn't understand the dividing line between what the state General Assembly does and what Congress does. And so we get asked a lot of times to help with things that are really not federal issues. And so there's plenty of things to talk to the legislators about and say, hey, we're hearing this. You all might, pursue this issue. We can't really, or we don't want to pursue it at the federal level. I'm very much have a federalist mindset. And so, we want the states to do, as much as they can, because I think generally speaking, they're going to do a better job of it than the federal government. For goodness sakes, we see that with the mess in Washington that exist right now. And so, there's a lot for us to talk about.
Yeah. And I think I've said this before, and I don't say it because I'm a county commissioner, but to me, it's reality. County government, city government impact the residents probably the most than state government. But the federal government has the big overview, the big 40,000 foot view that affects everyone and what we're doing. And so county government and city government and state government are watching you all, right? And what you all do sometimes impacts the way county governments and county commissions approve things. And so I think it's important to communicate with each other.
Absolutely. And frankly, I would say the federal government probably has too large of an impact on local, state, and federal government at this point, and on the local and state side, I should say. That's been one of those things that I've learned from being in Washington is that the founders did not envision it this way. They wanted government to be close to the people. They wanted the federal government to have a limited, area of responsibility. They tried to set that out in the Constitution. I think they did actually a pretty good job of it. Yep. But unfortunately, through the years, we've found ways around. The Congress has found ways around it. And that creates a lot of the problems that we have in this country, frankly, are places where the federal government is doing things that state and local government really should be doing.
Yeah, I agree. So let's get to some things that I know people want to hear about. The big, beautiful bill, as it's been deemed. You all have done, for now, you've done your part, right? Which is one of the reasons you're here with me in Cookeville instead of D.C., which is in the Senate, waiting on them to get through some things. You got opinions, you got some positives, negatives. What are your thoughts? What is the big, beautiful bill doing for us as a country?
Well, absolutely. And we like to, the president likes to identify it as the one big, beautiful bill. And so I always try to say that. And, I think the starting point would be to say passing this is important for working Americans. This would be the biggest tax cut in American history for working and middle class Americans. So I think you should start with that starting point. Put another way, if we don't pass the One Big Beautiful Bill, next January 1st, we're going to see the largest tax increase in American history. So this matters to everyday working Americans. The typical family of four in Tennessee would see about $11,600 impact if the One Big Beautiful Bill passes. That's the tax benefit that they'll receive. So it does matter to working Americans. So there are a lot of good things in it. You're right. The House finished our work, 4 weeks ago, I think, roughly, and sent it to the Senate. The Senate, as we sit here tonight doing this interview, they're in the process of considering amendments, and they call it a voterama. And so they're going to be voting for half a day or more on various amendments. Hopefully they don't mangle the bill too much, and when it comes back to the House, it'll be in a condition that we can pass it swiftly. That's the hope. If they mess it up too much, then there'll probably be a pretty high likelihood that we end up in what's called a conference committee, where the House and Senate appoint representatives and they come together. The Congress hasn't done a full-bore conference committee in a while, but Speaker Johnson has committed that that's the way we'll proceed if the bill ends up getting messed up to the point that we can't get the votes in the House. I'm hopeful that we still get the votes. It is, on balance, a good bill for America. Obviously the tax cuts that we've already talked about, which will spur economic activity and growth. That's why it's important to do this quickly, because the sooner we do it, the quicker that business owners all across this country will have the signal and the certainty of knowing what their tax picture is going to look like going forward. And as a small business owner myself, I'll tell you, it makes a big difference. For example, the R&D, the expensing of R&D expenditures by businesses is included in this bill. For my business, where we develop computer software, this matters a lot. And if this bill passes, then we'll know that we can hire more people, keep more of our current people on staff. If it doesn't pass, then we know we're not going to get the same favorable tax treatment for the salaries of those employees. And so that will be a deterrent to us and other businesses like us all across the country. So a lot in the bill. We can keep talking about it, but it's important to get it done and get it done quickly.
You don't have a crystal ball, and I don't expect you to know, but do you have a time frame you think this will be passed by?
I think if the Senate gets their work done here in the next several hours, that we'll get it done before the 4th of July. I suspect the president will be sitting at having a signing ceremony, maybe on the 4th of July, and there'll be a lot of symbolism there.
So there's a chance you could be flying out of here after we get done with this radio show, or tomorrow.
Probably not. It probably will be tomorrow at this point, because they'll give us 24 to 48 hours notice of when we're supposed to be back in Washington. But almost certainly if it passes the Senate, I'll be going back to Washington this week.
How does this bill differ from the last couple of bills or budgets, I guess you could say, that you've seen? The administration's changed. It's President Trump's back in for his second term. He was, wasn't in last term. But how's it in your mind? How does it differ?
Well, I think, first of all, we'll be providing real substantive tax relief to Americans, both working Americans and American businesses. And so it'll be good for the economy and continue to spur economic growth. We do in this bill reverse a lot of the Biden era policies. For example, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which we all know now caused inflation. It didn't prevent it. A lot of those provisions, the so-called IRA, will be rolled back. And so this will be the most consequential piece of legislation to come out of Congress in the 6.5 years that I've been there. Really, not since the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will we have done something that I think will have as positive an influence on the American economy. And of course, we remember no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, a tax credit for interest on American-produced cars that will benefit not only the auto industry, but all Americans who get to take advantage of that. And you think about the local parts suppliers in our area that will benefit from this as well. So a lot good here, not to mention then turning away from the tax policy area and thinking about the president, of course, has done a magnificent job of getting illegal immigration under control at our southern border. I mean, a real masterclass in leadership. But this will provide the president with the resources to complete the border wall, the resources to hire additional ICE agents and CBP agents to get illegal immigration under control in this country.
Yeah, and so I'm guessing a lot here, but with my knowledge, a lot of the phone calls you get from constituents are related to what you just mentioned, tax cuts. How can you better serve my family or help my family with, we don't have to pay as much taxes. And would that be the majority of your phone calls is taxes, or do you get an array of stuff?
A vast array of stuff. A lot of people are concerned about the so-called cuts. And, you know, what I would say there, cuts to various benefit programs. So there are some important savings that are a part of this. And I think it's I'm glad you said that, because I've neglected talking about this. This will be the largest cut in spending in the history of the country as well. And so about $1.6 trillion in cuts identified that are really savings and elimination of waste, fraud, and abuse. So one of the primary ways we're going to achieve those savings is by introducing a work requirement for those people who are getting SNAP benefits if you're an able-bodied adult without dependents. And so that's important to note. These are people who don't have a reason not to be in the labor force, who now will be encouraged to get into the labor force. And they don't have to get a job, but they got to do something productive so they can volunteer for worthwhile causes. There's a number of ways that they can meet this requirement. And again, this is not single moms at home that have got children to take care of. These are able-bodied adults without dependents.
Right.
And so, you know, getting them back into the labor force will also be good for the economy. And I think that's one of the things that's very important. And it's part of the reason the timing is so important, is that if we get it passed, we spur economic growth. We'll see that translate into increased revenues for the federal government. And so at the end of the day, this won't cost. It will pay.
Yeah. And I saw, before we break, I mentioned this. I saw that last week, I think every county in Tennessee has a unemployment rate 5% or less, which I'm not sure that's happened in years.
It's phenomenal, and it's a really positive thing that we've seen post-COVID. And I know you know in your work, one of the amazing things that happened is, I think, you know, if you want to find a positive, a silver lining in COVID, is that a lot of people came home. They came back to the places that they were from, mm-hmm. or they moved to rural areas. And that's been really good for Tennessee.
Yeah. Thank you for that information, Congressman. I'm with Congressman John Rose. This has been Rogers on Local Matters. We'll be back with more from the Congressman after this break. Welcome back to Local Matters. This has been Rogers with Congressman John Rose. He serves the 6th Congressional District here in our area in Putnam County and so many other counties. And we didn't even talk about that this episode, Congressman, how wide of a range your area is. But you've done a great job talking about the one big beautiful bill. So I paid attention to you. The one big beautiful bill that President Trump has introduced, Congress, the House has deliberated, and y'all have met. Now it's in the Senate's hands. We're hoping within the short time period they're getting through it. Anything else worth mentioning to our listeners about the Big Beautiful Bill?
Well, I have the great honor of serving on the Agriculture Committee, and one of the and this has kind of escaped large widespread notice, but the one Big Beautiful Bill also has in it important provisions for our nation's farmers. And so the farm safety net that kind of keeps our farmers in business when they're in tough times, and these are really tough times for agriculture right now. Over the last 4 years, we haven't seen any new market access during the Biden administration, and so our exports have declined. But at the same time, farmers have found themselves in a cost-price squeeze. Inflation has impacted them dramatically in terms of the cost of the inputs that they have. And so this bill would provide as much as $50 billion in new assistance to farmers, and particularly those that are being hit the hardest by the current economic situation. In fact, the Ag Committee, we're calling it Farm Bill 1.0. We've been struggling to try to get the Farm Bill across the finish line, and this will get some of the most nettlesome issues in the Farm Bill are included in the One Big Beautiful Bill. So that will be good for them. And then for those who are Second Amendment advocates, and I certainly count myself among those, the National Firearms Act for years has had a tax on silencers. This bill will remove that tax. And so for Second Amendment advocates and gun enthusiasts, this is going to be a major step in the right direction for them as well.
Well, I know I live in a rural area, Putnam County, and I have my guns. I like to shoot them, you know, at trees or targets. But I also have neighbors that do, and sometimes I wish they had a silencer because it's loud. But anyway, that's an interesting part of the bill. You mentioned $1.7 million in cuts in this bill. Obviously, that should help our deficit, right?
$1.6 trillion, yes. So this will be the biggest expenditure cut in American history. And so that's a very critical part of this. Obviously, as we sit here today, we're officially at $36.2 trillion in debt. It's actually more like $37.2, mm-hmm. but the way the government's been keeping track of that, they haven't been actually adding the increasing debt to the actual total debt total. So we've got to get that under control. This is by no means the last step there. This is, in fact, just a very meaningful first step. So that's something that I think is left to be desired in this bill, is it probably doesn't, in my view, go far enough. And in fact, I had expressed severe concerns about it when we were passing it in the House, and for a time period was negotiating with the Speaker and others to try to get more significant cuts included. But it's a positive step in the right direction, and it's a good first step. And we've got it. You got to start somewhere. You know, oftentimes people compare the federal government to an aircraft carrier. It takes a while to turn it. So you got to start turning it before you can get it turned around.
Well, yeah, we're not going to cut $36 trillion out of the budget in 1 year, right? It's a process, but at least we're trying to get to that point. Because I know even on the local government level, we like to bring up the country's deficit. And I'm like, well, local government's not impacting that, but I get calls about it. You know, as a commissioner, well, you know, what are we going to do about the deficit? There's nothing I can do about it. Call Congressman John Rose. And I'm not giving your number out, but anyway, but that's just part of what y'all are dealing with every day. And then, you talk about the farmers. I mean, that's your background, right?
That and
computer science is your background, which I love the diversity of that. I'm talking to somebody that's impacted the computer world, the IT world, but it's also impacted our agriculture. And that's part of your background. And I think how many calls do you get from farmers in your area?
Oh, I get tons of calls. And I also serve on the Financial Services Committee, and might just digress here for a second.
Sure.
To talk about, we recently passed a very important bill through the House that will protect new home buyers from getting inundated with spam calls and text messages and emails and mail. And so, you know, I get to work in a lot of different areas, and, you know, very excited about that. We call it the Home Buyers Privacy Protection Act, just passed through the House last week, and very excited. Got to go back through the Senate before we get to the president's desk, but hoping that happens in the near future.
Every day, it goes without fail, I get a text message from somebody that's wanting me to pick them up from the airport, or I'm late for dinner. Where are you? And I'm like, why are these people texting me? What do they want my response to be? Well, I'm on my way. Here's my credit card number. I don't know what the point is, but I'm hoping that goes away, because it's annoying. And I'm sure you get them too as a congressman.
Absolutely.
Hey, where are you at? Aren't you supposed to pick me up from the airport? I'm like, I don't know you. So anyway, speaking of your background with agriculture, which was in the state level, right? And you're a big part of that. You have announced that you're running for governor in 2026. And far as I know, as of today, you're the only person that's announced officially. Is that right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
I'm just going to ask the question, what made you want to go to that level of service? You are serving in the congressional district, and you're doing a wonderful job at the federal level. What made you decide to pursue a governor at the state level?
Well, as you know, I'm a Christian conservative outsider, husband, father, and a farmer. And you're right. That's one of those things that I take a lot of pride in. I'm an eighth generation Tennessean. My forebears got here in 1790. And remarkably, I get the great honor of farming the same land that they came here from North Carolina to farm, you know, sight unseen,
right,
when this was the frontier.
Sure.
And so, you know, because of that, I have a kind of special love in my heart for Tennessee and the things that make Tennessee special, our Tennessee values. And so I think that, you know, we're in a good place in lots of ways in Tennessee. We've had good local and state leadership. And as a result of that, Tennessee's in a very different place than the federal government. We have the lowest debt per capita of any state in the country. We have low taxes, low regulations, a hospitable social environment. And because of that, people are flocking to our state. Everyone in Tennessee knows that. And so I'm very concerned that if we don't have aggressive, effective, frankly, visionary leadership over the next 8 years, that we could lose what makes Tennessee special. And that's really what's motivating me to run for governor. So back on March 20th, now more than three months uh-huh. ago, I announced my candidacy. At the time, that was a little on the early side, not necessarily early by historic standards. In the last two open seat gubernatorial elections, people were getting in January. So
right.
We weren't necessarily early, but now I'm the only one in the race, and it's very late.
Yeah.
As Yogi Berra would say, it's getting late early.
Yep.
And so, you know, we've been making our way across the state. I've been to all 95 counties and, you know, have just been gratified by how well we've been received. And we've been building our team. And what I've come to know, and I probably didn't fully appreciate at the point I was getting into the race, is that setting up a statewide campaign is not an easy or trivial thing.
Right.
And it's not just about having the money. It's about putting together an organization. it's a lot like starting a small business, and I've done that, you know, so I've know the, you know, you start out, you do everything, and then you eventually get help, and you start to get to assign people tasks, and, you know, you enlarge your capacity to get the job done. And we've been doing that. And so that's why I think it's actually a little bit late now, because we've assembled kind of a world-class team. We've got one of the best consulting firms in the country working for us. We've got a great campaign manager in Chris Devaney, who's kind of like the starting quarterback for the last championship team. Right. So that's great. He helped with the Lee campaign 8 years ago. And so we put together just a world-class team, and we're on the trail and meeting new folks every day, spreading the word about my candidacy and listening to Tennesseans.
Well, and I want to get into more of that. We have one more segment with you if you've got time, and I appreciate your time so far. But I want to hear about your goals and your vision for Tennessee. And it's no reflection on the current administration. They've done a good job. Like you mentioned, we're in a good position. But I'm excited to hear what you plan on doing. I'm Ben Rogers on Local Matters. I have Congressman John Rose with me. We'll be back in a moment after this break. Welcome back to Local Matters. Ben Rogers in a great episode so far. Congressman John Rose is here. Talked about the big, beautiful bill. Talked about all the important parts of that and what it looks like and if it's passed. And thank you, Congressman, again for being here. I know your schedule's tight, but appreciate your time. We just got into last segment your decision to run for governor. And as you said, you're the only one so far that's announced their candidacy for the governor of Tennessee in 2026. And we are in the middle of 2025. So we're but roughly 12 months from a primary for the governor's seat in August, 11 months really, in August of next year. What you had mentioned, you bragged on the current administration, our current governor has done a good job, Tennessee's in a good position. What are some of the things you're looking to do as governor?
Sure. So I started talking to Tennesseans, of course, as a member of Congress years ago, but in earnest talking to them about Tennessee and thinking about possibly running for governor probably more than a year ago now. And from that, I've formulated what I think are kind of the five most important goals that I hear consistently from Tennesseans. And I talked about that when I made my announcement back on March 20th. But I continue to learn. And as I've said on the campaign trail, at the end of the day, it's not about what I want. It's about what Tennesseans want for the future of their state. And so I've been listening carefully and you know, refining my understanding of what Tennesseans are thinking about, what I think they see as the challenges and the solutions that they have. And you know, everywhere I go, I learn a little bit more, particularly from people who are active in local and state government or who have businesses or who think about these things involved with nonprofits, et cetera, that have a pretty keen awareness of what the challenges are in Tennessee. So those five, and I'll say them quickly and we can talk more about them, but education, infrastructure, access to health care, access to energy, and economic and community development. Those are the five. And I hear those things consistently. Now, I will say, before I jump into those things and talk about them, there are areas of the state where there are problems that kind of rise above those five. So, for example, if you're in Shelby County, the number one topic is crime.
Yes.
And frankly, they can't see past that because it's such a scourge on that community right now. And so anybody gets elected governor of the state is going to have to figure out how to confront crime in Memphis. And of course, there are other pockets of problems like that across the state. You know, you might point to Davidson County. They certainly have some issues there. And there are a few other special issues around the state. You know, the old quote, all politics is local, and I think that's very true. And so I'm getting a taste of that as I you know, branch out across the 95 counties of Tennessee. And so, you know, let's start with education. Every governor in my adult lifetime, going all the way back to Lamar Alexander, has made education the centerpiece of their program as a governor. And probably before that, I was just too young to know it, I imagine. But and yet we are still not where we need to be as a state, frankly.
Right.
And so that's the bad news. The good news is that particularly I credit the last three governors, I think, have made important steps in the right direction. Governor Bredesen made some contributions in that he recognized that the way we were keeping score wasn't accurate. So we were kind of patting ourselves on the back, but that wasn't real. And he took stock of that and changed the scorekeeping. And we started to get not so flattering assessments, but they were real. And so we've got to improve the quality of education and expect more from the system, get more from the system, and improve the outcomes for our students. At the end of the day, we want our our kids, and my kids are in public schools. My son is just finished the first grade in Smith County, and we want them to get a quality education that prepares them for the jobs of the future. And so one of the things that I believe is that 90% of our kids are going to go through the public school system. And so I've made a pledge to our Tennessee public school teachers that if I'm elected governor, we're going to have a commissioner of education that has spent time teaching in a Tennessee public school. And some people say, well, why does that matter? And the reason that I think it matters, my mom was a teacher, my sister was a teacher, my brother-in-law was a teacher, and I think they need to know that we have the confidence in someone coming out of a Tennessee classroom to lead education in Tennessee, someone who has a firsthand understanding of what's happening in our classrooms here. Because at the end of the day, we're not going to get education right if we don't inspire public school teachers to get the job done. And they can get the job done. So I've talked a lot about the bad news. The good news is the latest NAEP scores indicate that Tennessee is making really substantial positive gains, both in real terms and in relative terms. So we're doing well, we're doing better, and we're doing better relative to our peer states across the country. And in fact, for the first time, some of our scores have us in the top half, which is a major milestone for Tennessee. And here, I think, is the positive news for Tennesseans. And this came from SCORE, the State Collaborative on Reforming Education, who keeps up with education policy in our state. If in each of the next 8 years we got one more student per classroom to attainment levels, and we did that each year for 8 years, Tennessee would suddenly be in the top 10 nationally in terms of our results for education. Now, that's not saying that's easy,
right,
but to kind of break it down that way and say it's very manageable that we can move education forward. So a focus on education. Second is infrastructure. You know, and primarily I'm talking about roads, but it's certainly with the work that you do and serving us on the county commission, you know some of the other challenges. So we have challenges with roads. We have challenges with water treatment. We have challenges with wastewater treatment. We have challenges with solid waste disposal. And so we just have not been investing enough in infrastructure in our state. And we see that probably most demonstrably with the roads. Anyone who gets out on our interstate highways and tries to travel across Tennessee, you're going to come to a complete stop at some point.
Yes.
In the past, that was because there was an accident or there was road construction or something slowing down the roads. Increasingly, it's just because there's too many people on the roads.
Yeah.
And so contrast to where we were 25 years ago in Tennessee. 25 years ago, our roads were ranked among the best in the country. We don't have that problem right now.
Right.
That accolade. We've fallen behind, and I think it really underscores my overarching point, which is if you take your eye off the ball, you're going to fall behind. And we took our eye off the ball with respect to roads in Tennessee, and now we've got a lot of catch-up work to do.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, and I want to give you a break here because it's a great job explaining, but you just get on Interstate 40. You know, you live in Putnam County from exit 288, which is 111 here, and then down to Baxter. There's a ton of people, and an 8-mile stretch, a ton of people on the interstate almost all the time. And it's because our people are traveling through and living here. More people are living here. And you're right. It's become a problem. It's congestion causes accidents, and accidents causes harm and then costs money and all that. So we got to find a solution somewhere.
We do. And that's not an easy solution. I don't want to mislead
right.
anyone. We've got some tough choices to make about how we're going to solve that problem in Tennessee. And so infrastructure is very near the top in terms of importance. And then third, I said access to healthcare. Anyone who talks to healthcare providers across the state will know that we've got a real problem, a challenge in Tennessee. We've lost more rural hospitals than any state in the country except for Texas. And we have counties in this state where there is no primary care. There's no hospital. There are no primary care physicians. Not one. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
We're blessed here in Cookeville with great health care and great providers. But that's not true everywhere across the state. In fact, in the 6th District, we have 5 counties that do not have a hospital mm-hmm. at present. Now, that points to part of the solution, because I'm not talking about creating some massive new entitlement. I'm just talking about fostering the services so that they're available in each county across the state. And so I worked hand in hand with a lot of folks to get a standalone emergency room and clinic in Fentress County that lost its mm-hmm. hospital very early in my term as congressman. And that has, I think, really lays out a model for how we may confront this. So now, unfortunately, for a number of years, if you needed emergency care in Fentress County, you had to be taken out of the county and brought either to Cookeville or Crossville or Knoxville or one of the adjoining counties. But now they have a standalone emergency room where you can be treated and triaged and then moved on if you need more long-term care to a hospital in an adjoining county. And that, I think, may be the blueprint for how we solve this problem across Tennessee. One of the other things that's a special focus there for me is access to mental health care. And again, anyone in the public service space, if you're involved in healthcare, running an emergency department, or you're the sheriff in a county, or you're involved in the judicial system, or if you're involved in assisting folks with the homelessness problems across our state, you know that very often many of the people you're dealing with are suffering from chronic mental illness. And so the state has got to do something to provide care for the chronically mentally ill across our state.
Yeah, that's been a huge topic in counties for years now, right? Because the sheriff's office are transporting people to mental hospitals or mental health establishments, and they're just send them right back.
Right. There are not enough beds for mental patients in Tennessee. There's not enough capacity in the system to treat the chronically mentally ill. And we created this problem ourselves decades ago with the policies that we put in place. But what's becoming obvious is that as bad as it may have been in the past with respect to the quality of care that mental patients were receiving, not providing them with care becomes very expensive to society because we're paying for it through higher emergency room costs. Our jails are clogged with people who are really there because they're mentally ill. And then our court system is clogged. Yeah. And then we see them suffering as homeless people. And so, you know, we've got to take stock of that in our state. And then fourth, access to energy, electricity. We're literally turning businesses away from Tennessee. And some listeners may not know that, but we're literally telling businesses that want to come to our state and create jobs, we can't accommodate you. So we've got to fix that.
Right.
And then finally, economic and community development, all those lead into that. What I would say there is we want to be able to be selective. We want to bring jobs here that we want our children to have, and we want to bring businesses to Tennessee that will respect our values. And too many times we've brought businesses to our state that then turn around and tell us we need to change.
Yes, I've seen that. It's not funny, but it makes me chuckle because we've seen that here in Cookeville. Yeah. So, Congressman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on Local Matters, Ben. It's been a pleasure to be with you on 94.1.
Well, I want you to come back before the election next year. Maybe we can talk more about what's going on and where you're going with the governor's race. So I appreciate your time. Folks, been a pleasure to have Congressman John Rose come in with us on Local Matters. This has been Rogers. Remember, it's a lot easier to smile than it is a frown. Make somebody's day. Be kind to one another. It's the only way we make it through this life. We'll see you next week.